I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, art collection.
When you want to be a collector, how do you know what you want to collect? How do you know what's out there?
I think that there's an element of seeing things on the street in places that you're not expecting it. That for me is just like so exciting.
It's a very nondiscreet dark room, and there's a little discreet button on the wall that you hit, and suddenly whoosh, this thing erupts, and it's a phoenix coming out of the trash can. And the phoenix, of course, is the symbol for the city of Atlanta. And what Michael was trying to encapsulate there was everything should be able to come alive. Everything should be able to be a puppet.
Some work just needs to be large, I think. There's work that you can sort of hold, and then there's work that holds you, and that's a different experience, I think, as a participant, as when you're viewing art, to be literally embraced by a massive monumental piece of artwork versus finding a gem or a jewel.
It's all about education, especially for someone who's just getting started. And the fun part about educating yourself as a collector is it's usually done with a glass of wine in hand. And the way that you train yourself, the way that you educate yourself, is just going out and looking and asking questions from other collectors and dealers, from the artists.
This is a community of artists that is really worth investing in. And it's worth investing in the same way that artists in New York or Houston or L.A. is worth investing in. And I think that the thing that we have heard from the Flux Night events is people will say, that was amazing. I felt like I was living in a different city. Or, you know, this didn't feel like Atlanta. And that to me is sort of at the core of what we're trying to do, is to bring a really innovative art, a really unique experience that also gives people a great pride in Atlanta and greater knowledge about the amazing art that's being made here.
My guests today are Lewis Corrigan, creator and president of Flux Projects.
I think I've stumbled through the whole thing, and it's just sort of one thing leads to another obvious, either an obvious need that you think, well, gosh, who's going to solve that? Oh, I guess I can try. And you know, the more you do, the more you find reason to do the next thing.
Spalding Nix, the founder of Spalding Nix Fine Art.
And at Sotheby's, we talked about the three D's all the time, every day. Death, debt, divorce. That's what keeps all these things getting back out there on the market. That's why it can be really fun and exciting. It's not staid. It's not, you know, all the pieces haven't made it to the museums yet. There's still a lot out there, and collectors, they know where they are.
Marketing director for the Center for Puppetry Arts, Daniel Summers Jr.
One of my favorite memories was walking through our exhibit, and there was a lady from India, a grandmother, talking to her grandchildren, and the dad was just standing back, just admiring his mother. And she was relating what puppetry was like back in India when she was a child, and how those traditions, and here are these puppets that, you know, the puppets themselves are built in the 70s, but it's off of an ancient tradition where they're trying to stick as closely as they can to their traditional art forms. And this child had never heard his grandmother speak so well of, you know, India. He'd heard of this place, but he'd never had that connection. You know, wait, you were a little kid, Grandma? What do you mean?
And celebrated Atlanta photographer and artist Todd Murphy.
I'm interested in the creative act. And so if that reveals itself as a painting or a photograph or a business or an idea, or, you know, it's the verb.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, art collection. What would you say to someone that's starting to collect? What's important to look for, and what should they be looking for?
You have to collect what you like. You have to find something that seduces you, that you fall in love with. And what you like can change over time. As you educate yourself, your likes may change, and people grow in and out of likes. But finding out what you like is the most important step. Your collection, it can't just be an investment. It can't be just following what's trendy in the art market. It really has to be something not only that you like, but you love, and that you want to spend your time with, because these are the things that become a part of your life, that become a part of your home. And those are the things that you're going to be, you know, living with and thinking about and enjoying every day.
Well, you're a appraiser as well.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to figure out values. Why would someone need to know the value of a piece of art? With the thought of, if I'm collecting what I like, who cares how much it really becomes, how much the value is, financial value.
Sure. Well, value is very important. And for especially young collectors, you really want to be looking for value. You know, you don't want to be, you want to be buying the best that you can buy with the money that you've got. That's what, to me, what value is. And then after you've started to make those purchases, the reason why people hire appraisers, usually it's something practical. They need it. Insurance companies hate art because it's something that can't be easily replaced, so they often demand to have the art appraised in case something goes wrong. But for other reasons, a lot of my work is collectors do spend a lot of time helping museums build collections. They're making charitable contributions. They want to have it appraised so they can get their deduction from the IRS. There's all sorts of different reasons that people have items appraised. Usually, it's not because they want to find out how much money they've made on their purchases. They usually have more practical purposes.
Since you bring up museums, in terms of collecting, that's probably the type of collecting that people are most familiar with or at least most exposed to.
You know, art is a lot, I think, at this highest level, has a lot to do with totem, has a lot to do with fetish. People are spending tens of millions, if not, there's an one of the copies of The Scream is about to be sold in early May, and they're projecting that it's going to go for, it's estimated right now at $80 million. And then there's a lot of people saying that it could go for $100 to $150 million. So here we are, these objects.
Well, can we talk about that for a minute? Because The Scream, it was stolen, what, like 3 or 4 years ago? Mm-hmm. Is that right? Like, okay, so you go and you steal something right. That's worth $100 million. You can't even go sell it. Why are you stealing it?
Art thieves usually have very strange reasons for why they steal these things. And The Scream that was stolen in Norway was stolen by a mafia boss who was trying to divert the public's attention from a bank theft that had gone wrong. A security guard was shot and the country was outraged. And so he said, well, guys, in order to get the heat off of this bank robbery, why don't you go steal The Scream? And so they did, and eventually they got caught in Scream. There's four copies of The Scream out there. The one that's going to be sold in May is the last in private hands. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, he stole this thing just as a diversion. And people do steal things, that sometimes thinking they can resell them. But the high profile that works that are worth that kind of money, you know, only the black market is really going to be able to absorb something like that. And usually they just use it as a commodity at that point. You know, I owe you $1 million for this arms deal. Let me give you this $10 million painting as a down payment. They treat it like gold or, you know, something similar.
Interesting. Where does Atlanta fit into like in the spectrum of collecting kind of, I don't know, nationally, internationally?
I think that for a long time, Atlanta was a big small pond when it came to the arts community, but it has grown leaps and bounds in the past 20 years, and it's a real center for the Southeast when it comes to collecting. We have a vibrant contemporary art scene. I think photography, championed by Jane Jackson in the early 90s, is a real niche that Atlanta is very strong at when it comes to collecting and being a real educated market here. You know, Elton John's a hometown boy and has one of the best photography collections in the world. And his photography is like wallpaper. He has it from the floor to the ceiling on every wall because that's what inspires him. That's what he wants to have be a part of his life. And I think a lot of artists are that way.
And what about the High Museum?
Well, the High Museum was a latecomer, I think most would agree, as a museum, because by the time the High was really established in the mid-20th century, most of the big museums had been around for a long time, and their collections had been around for, you know, a century by that point. So the High Museum had to decide, well, what's still out there? What can we collect? What can we afford? And what should we focus on? And, you know, for a long time, I think they were one of the first museums who decided we're going to focus on Victorian furniture. And they have an incredible collection of Victorian furniture. But today, how many people are interested in Victorian furniture? So I think the High made a very good decision when it said, let's be current. Let's look at what's happening with contemporary art, because that's a field where we could still really make an impact. And they've had some really great photography curators, contemporary art curators, who've really helped push the High along in that direction.
I collect no stamps, no lamps, no pictures of chance.
I collect no pens, no cans, no Spanish lace fans.
I collect no mats,
no hats, no Siamese cats.
Oh, what a hobby this is. I just collect your kisses. I collect.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Art Collection. When we think of collecting for public consumption, we think naturally first of institutional actors like the High Museum. But when we look outside of the museum walls, there are others facing down these same issues with a very different approach.
You know, I buy art, like other people, but I don't think of myself as collecting art. I buy it because I like it. I buy it because I'm excited by the artists and I want to support them. But I think that increasingly that I'm collecting experiences, and I think that the value is, there certainly is a monetary value in what it costs to do it. But I think that the value to me is in how well it works and whether or not it has an impact, and then on how large an audience it has an impact, whether it is really kind of generative and kind of showing people something new and opening up new possibilities. I mean, it's much more both the pleasure of the experience and then also the kind of larger cultural work that I hope it can do.
That's Lewis Corrigan, founder of Flux Projects, one of Atlanta's most ambitious public arts organizations.
Well, so Flux is a one-night event of public art, and it basically takes over the entire Castleberry neighborhood. Last year, we had about 30 public projects. We are likely to have even more this year. There are projection pieces on walls. There are dance pieces going through the streets. There are sculptural installations. A lot of it is light-based because it's nighttime. But it's intended to really be an opportunity for Atlanta artists to do public work, which until the last few years, they haven't had that many opportunities to be commissioned, paid to do public projects, to really stretch themselves to try to reach kind of a broader audience.
Let's talk about the broader audience, because as much as it's about exposure for the artist, it's also about exposing the viewing audience to art and in this new and unusual context.
The discovery process, I think, is a big part of what Flux is doing. I mean, we do projects throughout the year in different public spaces. We want to try to put art in people's everyday lives. So we did a great project last year, a ladder project by Charlie Brower that was in Freedom Park, where it was visible from the street, it was in the park, you could ride your bike by and stop and take photos. And it was a community art project in the sense that it required people to donate ladders, and he built this huge sculpture out of the ladders. So we're trying to kind of reach the everyday person in Atlanta and throw art in their path. And there's a great discovery process
literally to
that. Yeah, I mean, we kind of want to surprise people. I mean, we have a project now. Carolyn Lathan Stifel has got these things basically growing on the department store building at the corner of Edgewood and Boulevard.
Yeah, what's that about?
Well, it's she's very interested in making work out of pipe cleaners and sort of issues of nature and basically the building is going to be slowly be covered over the course of about 5 months here. And I think that those projects that will surprise you, where you're driving along and you're like, oh my God, what is that? And it's even good if you're not sure at first what it is.
Here's a question though. Like, yes, this is public art, meaning like for the citizens, but also for the city itself, right?
Yes.
And so how do you go about collecting artists, which is what you do, to then display their art for a city. How do you curate a city?
Well, I mean, I think there are two things to that. I think that at the first point, I think of what we're doing as actually a bit activist. And before you get to the curating of the city, you have to think of what the city, I think, is a kind of canvas. And I want to see creativity visible on the street, visible in everyday life. I want it to permeate our existence. And I think that that has a really exciting effect on people, where if they come across something that they're not expecting and they think, oh my God, who did that? How is that possible? That it's a way of kind of reimagining what's possible in your own personal life, but just in your everyday life, your relationships with other people, and bringing people together through art and a sense of community. But in terms of finding the artist, you know, we want to give Atlanta artists opportunities to do stuff. And so we're always talking to people and seeing what they're interested in doing, looking for people that we think could do a good public project for us, either for the Flux Night event or for a different project. But we also do a call for proposals. And it's exciting just in the call. We just had our deadline for proposals for this year's Flux. And the first year, we got about 80 proposals that were specific to the one night. Last year, we got about 129, I think. And this year, we have, I think, 239. Wow. So there's been a kind of explosion in interest in people proposing things. We're reaching artists really all over the world, certainly all over the United States. We got proposals from California, New York, Philadelphia, Nebraska, I mean, all over the place. But, you know, we want to try to give, in particular, Atlanta artists an opportunity to grow. We're certainly looking for the most outstanding projects, but we're also looking for a certain mix of projects. I mean, something like Flux lends itself to a certain level of spectacle, because you want things to be noticeable, you want people to be impressed by it, you want it to have a kind of energy to it. You also want things that are just energy in the streets. I mean, when Glow ATL does a performance that goes all through the streets and people, you know, suddenly find themselves surrounded by dancers, that's really dynamic and amazing. And that's sort of, you know, Glow is basically a perfect model of what we're looking for, where you have this kind of dynamism, a sense of spectacle, but also an incredible sense of intimacy and real artistry involved. You know, there's amazing work that shows up in museums and galleries, but I do think there's a degree to which you get socialized into expecting and being able to read things a certain way if you go to a lot of galleries. And I think that what's great about the events at Flux is that it's all very unexpected and it's a totally new experience. I mean, you just can't see this in a gallery. You have to be there. And the fact that it's one night, I think, is a great pull to bring people out. And, you know, we were really happy that we had 10,000 people, but the goal for this, you know, in 3 years is many more. I mean, the model is Nuit Blanche in Toronto, where they got 1 million people out to see art in the city. And if we could get 1 million people out to see Flux at some point in Atlanta, I think that's going to be great for everybody in the arts in Atlanta.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Art Collection, brought to you by Perkins & Will, ideas and buildings that honor the broader goals of society. Let's now turn to one of Atlanta's most comprehensive and unusual art collections, though we rarely think of it as such.
So, the Center for Puppetry Arts is the largest nonprofit in the United States dedicated to the art form of puppetry. And what that really means is we are the largest entity in the United States that is solely dedicated to this vibrant art form that really exists in some form or fashion in every culture on our planet. The center uses an incredibly broad definition of puppet. Literally, anytime you take an inanimate object and animate it to help tell a story, that is a puppet.
So, like, if I take this pen and I'm using it to talk right now, and tell a story, it's a puppet.
As long as it's telling the story, it's being personified. Using it as just a pointer? No, it's just a pointer. But the minute you use it and it's, let's say, walking across the table, yeah, it's representing a person. You're telling a story of a journey. That becomes a puppet. Arguably, you could say it's the second eldest art form, the eldest being storytelling. But the minute you had to tell someone something and you had to use a prop to help tell that story, that's puppetry. And like I say, we have a very broad definition just so we can talk about things that you wouldn't normally consider to be a puppet, such as mask work. There's a lot of mask puppetry that's it's its own tradition, and it's completely separate and distinct from, let's say, marionettes or string puppet. And puppetry is just an aspect of modern theater. Your puppeteer is a type of actor. One of our fun little trivia facts at the center is UNIMA, the Union Internationale de la Marionnette, is actually the oldest performing art guild in the world. And it is a union of puppeteers that has existed for a few hundred years. And it literally was puppeteers trading their trade secrets. Puppeteers are like magicians in that they create illusions, but they're unlike magicians in that if you're interested in how a puppet works, a puppeteer will probably share the, no, this is how we do this. It's part of the magic of puppetry. We know these inanimate objects are being animated by a person. Oftentimes we see the puppeteer manipulating the puppet, but we also have this complete suspension of disbelief with them. We know Kermit is being manipulated by either Jim Henson or now Steve Whitmire, but it's still Kermit. And Steve Whitmire will tell the story of being approached by a lady who talks to Kermit and reminds him of back in the 1960s when he was on Ed Sullivan, and Kermit remembers being on Ed Sullivan. The fact that Steve wasn't even around when this was all going on, that does not matter. Kermit remembers where he was at.
But we go back to this definition of a puppet, and it really has to be used to tell a story to be
right.
A puppet. But in a museum, oftentimes, this work of art is
right.
Sitting there.
And the big sort of joke at the center is once something is acquiesced into a museum, once it actually becomes a museum artifact, and we are a museum, we have international standards that we have to comply with, we have a whole docent museum staff that is trained on how to handle these artifacts, and once you are put into a museum, you're no longer performed. And so if our definition of a puppet is an inanimate object that is being performed, we technically have the largest puppet museum that doesn't have puppets anymore. Puppets are meant to be performed. They're not meant to be archived. We actually have two collections on site, our performance puppets that are still puppets, and then the museum acquiesced objects, the artifacts.
So that's cool. Like, you are a museum. You have collections.
Right.
The actual works of art are not really part of the museum collection yet, and then the puppets cease to be puppets and become part of the collection.
Right. Except we don't just put our own puppets in there. You know, again, we have to follow international museum standards.
Right.
There's an entire process of vetting. Is this piece worthy of preserving? Because it is a very, it's a lifelong commitment, first off. You know, I mean, if you're going to put something in a museum, you have to be ready for it to be there forever, and you have to be able to provide for that artifact. And that goes for any museum. And one of the things that a lot of the public doesn't realize about all museums, we don't have space for our collections. The Center for Puppetry Arts only has space for a little bit under a third of our collection.
How many is in your total collection?
Oh, Lord, thousands of pieces. You can actually go online to puppet.org and tour our virtual catalog and just see all these puppets. And sometimes it's the exact same kind of puppet. A trick about puppetry that's unique to it, unlike other art forms. You have a Mona Lisa. You have a Statue of David. You have all of which are original, unique things. There are many original Big Birds. Big Bird does not do costume changes. Anytime you want to see Big Bird in a tuxedo, that's Big Bird with a tuxedo. That is a separate body puppet than Big Bird with a sombrero, which is separate than Big Bird as the normal Big Bird that we don't see with anything except his beautiful yellow feathers.
To conclude today, we're going to examine the role of collecting in the creation of art. Our guest and guide is Todd Murphy, whose work can be seen as part of the collections in museums, high-rise office buildings, hotspot restaurants, and prestigious galleries alike. But it's Todd's personal collecting of objects and artifacts that helped define his work. Eggshells, twigs, hay, fossils, skeletons, and photographs that he takes all make up a collection assembled together to create his acclaimed work.
Well, I think it's just the finding beauty in the everyday, in an object. I ever since I was little, I would in my own house growing up, I would go on thing searches where I would just sort of look through old, you know, drawers and find, you know, a piece of a broken watch or you know, some little objects, and they just sort of have their own voice or energy or poetry in them that I try to capture. That's it. I don't know. They just have a resonance. And when you're given a simple object, you create a universe out of it. And so I love systems in general, whether they're economic systems or biological systems or you know, you look at a building versus, you know, a master plan of a city, you know, how it fits in there. If you could Google anything now and come up with thousands and thousands of images of, you know, the sunset or the woods or a sidewalk. And so, you know, there are people, which I think is very interesting, who are just taking photographs that are being uploaded and creating a new conversation by using them. And so I don't know if it's necessarily as relevant as who took the picture as it is to recognize how to use the picture. I mean, even on these Antarctica photographs, you know, I came back and I couldn't even look at them for several months because every time I did, it just didn't seem as wonderful as the experience. And then after I let them sit for a while, I started to open them up and look at them, and then you realize, wow, I mean, that's beautiful, you know. But so much of it really did look like stock photography from National Geographic. And so I think, you know, the challenge is to try to still find your voice photographically. So the way I take pictures is really, I know how it feels when I'm looking at it there. And then oftentimes I look at the photographs and it's like, oh, those don't feel at all like that. And so working with the photograph to get it to, and that's the studio part, is to work with the photograph till it feels like what I saw. And that's hopefully what you see when you see the work is that's how, to me, I know it's done. It's like, oh, that literally just feels right.
I want to thank my guests today, Lewis Corrigan, Spalding Nix, Daniel Summers Jr., and Todd Murphy. Of course, we'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will. You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio. This is Gene Kansas. We'll see you next month.